It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
A key practical consideration is securing the product. For example, in a tire defect case, we had a case one time where the tire blew, and of course, ultimately, the vehicle rolled over and killed a young person. It was a terribly tragic case, but we immediately secured the tire, and we had experts evaluate the tire to determine whether or not there was either a manufacturing flaw in the tire that caused it to blow, or whether or not there was a design defect.
Private attorney Ted Allen from the law firm of Allen & Allen explains the law of product liability. And during this week's question and answer session, we talk about when your employer can be held liable for a fraudulent document used against you and when they can't. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 129, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Eligible residents of Virginia can apply for health insurance coverage through the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan, or PCIP, program run by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Congress created the temporary PCIP program as part of the Affordable Care Act to help uninsured Americans with a variety of medical conditions get affordable coverage rather than be locked out of the system by insurance companies. In 2014 and beyond, insurers will be prohibited from denying coverage to anyone with a pre-existing condition, and new competitive marketplaces called health insurance exchanges will give people the opportunity to shop for the policy that best suits their needs. Millions of Americans also will receive tax credits to help make coverage affordable. PCIP provides Americans living with such conditions as cancer, diabetes, or heart disease the opportunity to obtain insurance coverage. The program covers a broad range of health benefits and is designed as a bridge for people with pre-existing conditions who cannot obtain health insurance coverage in today's private insurance market. To qualify for PCIP coverage, you must be a citizen or national of the U.S. or lawfully present in the U.S. You must have been uninsured for at least the last 6 months before you apply. You must have a pre-existing condition or have been denied coverage because of your health condition. Starting July 1, 2011, you can simply provide a letter from a doctor, physician assistant, or nurse practitioner dated within the past 12 months stating that you have or at any time in the past have had a medical condition, disability, or illness. A denial from an insurance company is not needed. PCIP covers a broad range of health benefits, including primary and specialty care, hospital care, and prescription drugs. All covered benefits are available for you, even if it's to treat a pre-existing condition. In addition to your monthly premium, you will pay other costs. Before most medical benefits are covered, you first must pay a deductible, which varies by your plan option. But there is no deductible for preventative services, which can start right away. You also will pay copayments and 20% of the costs of any other covered benefits you get, but your out-of-pocket costs cannot be more than $5,950 per year. For more information, visit www.pcip.gov or call toll-free 1-866-717-5826. With This Week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Johnston versus Hargrove. After the tenant, N.D. Hargrove, had failed to make a scheduled rent payment for April 1883, the landlord, John Johnston, filed an unlawful detainer against the tenant for possession of the premises. A judgment was entered for the tenant, and the landlord appealed. On appeal, the Supreme Court of Virginia noted that the statute about unlawful detainer did not change common law rules about non-payment of rent. The common law said that a landlord could not exercise the right of possession for non-payment of rent until after he had made an actual demand upon the tenant for payment of unpaid rent. Since the landlord had failed to make the demand for unpaid rent upon the tenant, the court held that the landlord could not maintain his unlawful detainer. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault. And Johnston versus Hargrove is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Tammy, and I'm from Henrico County.
Welcome to the show. What question do we have this week?
I have a question concerning my employer. My former employer forged write-up documents.
And what happened as a result of the forged write-up documents?
They were submitted to another company. So I want to know if there's anything that I can do with this situation.
Well, if they were submitted to another company, then yeah, there definitely is something that you could do, assuming that you could prove that they were submitted to another company. I mean, in general, the employer's records on you are their property, and if they just stay in your personnel file and don't go anywhere, I mean, even if they're false, even if they're fraudulent, even if they're forged, if they don't go anywhere or impact you in any manner, then that's kind of private, secret, and confidential, and you've not been harmed. Similarly, if they're submitted to, let's say, the Virginia Employment Commission in an unemployment compensation case, they can be considered by the Virginia Employment Commission when they decide your claim. You have the right to confront and cross-examine and challenge them. And the Virginia Employment Commission is like Las Vegas. Whatever happens there stays there and cannot be used in any other proceeding for any other purpose. So even if they submit fraudulent documents to the Virginia Employment Commission, as long as you have a chance to challenge them, again, you've suffered no harm. But if those fraudulent forged documents circulate beyond the employer's own records and they circulate beyond the Virginia Employment Commission, where they are, as I said, private, secret, and confidential, and stay there, but if they go to another employer, then your former employer has probably violated the Code of Virginia, and the code section is 40.1-27, and I'll give you a summary of it. It says, no person in the Commonwealth, after having discharged an employee, shall willfully and maliciously prevent or attempt to prevent by word or by writing, directly or indirectly, a discharged employee from obtaining employment with another person. That sounds like exactly what happened. If they had used or sent a forged, fraudulent document to another employer, then they tried to prevent you from getting employment elsewhere. Now, the statute goes on to say that the section is not prohibit any person from giving on application from any other person a truthful statement for the reason for the discharge. But again, your argument would be that wasn't a truthful statement. It was a forged, fraudulent document. So if you could prove that your former employer basically sent written lies to another employer to keep you from getting a job, you've got a case. Okay, thank you much for being on the show. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law firm of Allen & Allen, and we are speaking with one of the partners, Ted Allen, and we're going to be talking today about products liability law. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Thank you, Martin.
Well, did you tell our audience, first of all, exactly what is products liability?
Well, there are a lot of different aspects of product liability, but the main one we think of is that involving personal injury. That is, if it's an unreasonably dangerous product that explodes or harms or causes personal injury, then what is the claim that you might have against the maker or seller of that product?
So can you give some examples of products that are found to be dangerous or otherwise subject to product liability?
Well, certainly it could be products such as just an automobile, for example, or it could be a consumer kind of product like a foodstuff or, you know, a food that you eat or drink you drink, you know, that's got some toxic basis to it that causes a reaction.
So what is the basis for finding someone liable for a product that they either manufacture or distribute or sell? What's the standard here that has to be met?
Well, the standard is the product defective in the sense that it was unreasonably dangerous at the time it was made or sold, and that that was in fact the cause of the injury? Of course, the plaintiff, the person who brings the claim, has the burden of proof as to proving both the defect and its cause of the incident, accident, injury.
Now, who can be sued for a defective or dangerous product? I mentioned a few entities that could be sued. Is there one in particular that you're looking for, or do you pretty much sue anyone who could potentially be responsible?
Well, you can call it the chain of distribution, starting with the manufacturer on down to suppliers and middlemen, so to speak, and then the actual seller. Oftentimes, it's the seller and the manufacturer.
So, in a situation where you're saying that a product is dangerous, now, surely it doesn't have to be 100% safety. So, what is the standard for showing that a product didn't meet the reasonable requirements of safety?
Well, there are different ways you can try to prove it up, and of course you have to employ experts, and that's part of the expense, which is frequently very expensive in these cases, quite frankly. So it justifies, or the claim would be justified if the injury is serious enough such that the recovery that you would expect might be large enough to pay for the kind of experts that you need to tell you, give you the expertise as to what is defective and what is not. You know, there are certain standards that may exist in the industry. There are certain government regulations that may set standards. So there are different ways that you might measure what would be unreasonably dangerous. But normally speaking, it has to do with the gravity of the harm that might be caused to the individual using the product.
Now, am I correct that just because you were injured doesn't mean that the product itself was defective?
Absolutely. As you know, the law is the mere happening of an accident is not relevant at all to the subject of whether or not there may be defect.
And do you find that the defendants in these cases often try to shift the blame to the user of the product? And if so, how do you deal with those types of defenses?
Well, there are a number of defenses. For example, that the individual misused the product is a very common defense, or that it was an obvious and open danger, and that it was an obvious thing that he actually assumed the risk of the use of that product. Another would be the alteration of the product. In other words, you can buy a consumer good, and then you can, over the period of time with wear and tear and different uses that you've made of it, actually alter it so that it's become defective, but it was not defective when it left the hands of the seller or the manufacturer. So, yes.
Now, what if a product is inherently dangerous, on, let's say, explosives or something of that nature, or a firearm, something of that nature? Is there a duty on the manufacturer, the seller, to warn a customer or a potential user of the inherent dangers of the product?
Generally speaking, no. Obviously, we're talking about, is it defective for its ordinary uses? But if, in fact, its intended use is to blow something up, for example, then, you know, that's its intended use, so it's not defective for its intended uses, just same as a knife blade, for example. You know, its intended uses are to cut. And so the fact that it cuts you does not mean it's defective.
What about somebody who is not a purchaser of the product? In other words, it was bought by someone else, used by the victim of a particular accident. Did they have a claim against the manufacturer, the seller, or does it have to be the actual purchaser?
Absolutely. It does not have to be the actual purchaser.
And what about products that you buy used as opposed to new? Could you still have a recovery in that type of situation as well?
Most products that are used are purchased what you and I know as is. No, they're not subject to warranties. We're talking basically about new product items here, and the question is whether or not there was a warranty at that time that was in effect breached, or that there was negligence at that time involving the purchaser or those in the chain of purchase. Now, for example, it is true that you could purchase a used product and the matter could be one of a design defect, for example, as opposed to a manufacturing defect. And you could prove that the design of the manufacturer was the same design that caused you injury in the used product. And then you could potentially, if you were able to carry the burden of showing that the product was the same at the time it was originally purchased, then you could potentially prove a design defect, but that would be a very difficult thing to do, incidentally, in most instances.
Now, you've done extensive amount of product liability litigation. Could you give our listeners sort of an example or two of cases that you have taken to court, either, you know, tried or settled, obviously not a confidential settlement, but just a flavor for the types of things that can be defective and how you go about proving them and the kind of damages that can be recovered?
A key practical consideration is securing the product. For example, in a tire defect case, we had a case one time where the tire blew and, of course, ultimately the vehicle rolled over and killed a young person. It was a terribly tragic case, but we immediately secured the tire and we had experts evaluate the tire to determine whether or not there was either a manufacturing flaw in the tire that caused it to blow or whether or not there was a design defect. In this particular case, the expert that we found was in England. We had to go all the way to England to get an expert because in tire cases, for example, all of the experts are pretty much controlled within the tire industry. So we had to find somebody independent of that. And then, of course, he did his examination and evaluation, which involves a lot of sophisticated testing. And then with his know-how, which he had know-how in the tire industry from which he had retired from, as you can imagine. And then ultimately he was able to produce a report for us and he withstood depositions and so forth. And, of course, the defense had their defenses in that case. But ultimately, we were able to get the case resolved with the tire company shortly before the case was set for trial. And many times until they've deposed all your experts and we've deposed theirs and you go through a significant amount of expense and so forth, ultimately the case gets resolved. But that's not inevitable by any stretch.
And when it comes down to a case of dueling experts, which it sounds like most of these cases pretty much have to come down to, and it does not get resolved, you take the case to trial. How do you, as the plaintiff, with the burden of proof, win the case if it's a case of dueling experts?
Well, of course, the civil burden of proof, as you know, Martin, is the preponderance of the evidence or the greater weight of the evidence. So sometimes we say more likely than not. Of course, the jury usually applies a stronger burden than that, but it's not the same as a prosecutor would have in a criminal case, which is we hear all the time, beyond a reasonable doubt. You don't have that standard. So normally we use the expert, and then hopefully the expert is able to show through demonstrative evidence graphically to the jurors to help them understand the technical principles, what it is about the product that was flawed or defective. And then in addition to that, you would have ways in which you could explain it to the jury so that they would understand it. But yes, when there are dueling experts and there's a battle between two people that look to the jury to be similarly qualified, it can be difficult to carry that burden of proof. So you want to make sure you have a strong case.
And do you often have your expert compare the alleged defective product with other products that are similar in the same category and show that this particular product was either designed differently, manufactured differently, or something like that to show that's why this product was defective and caused this injury?
Well, in the particular tire case, one of our claims was that we should have had an additional band within the tire and that some of the manufacturer's tires, even within this manufacturer's line of tires, included that additional pad, which we said would have given it some additional security from the blowout. And so, yes, we did use that kind of evidence, and I think that was one of the pieces of evidence that potentially concerned them the most.
And finally, if a consumer or a user is injured by a particular product that they believe to be defective, how much time do they have to bring a lawsuit?
Well, basically you have, and that really depends on the product and the situation, but usually and generally speaking here, we're talking about within 2 years in a personal injury case from the date of the injury itself.
Very good. We have been talking with Ted Allen. He is a partner in the law firm of Allen & Allen in the West End of Richmond, and we have been discussing product liability law. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Martin, thank you.
You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 16.1, which deals with courts not of record. Enact in 2010, Code of Virginia 16.1-79.1 says that the general district courts shall accept electronic filing for any civil action file. The use of the electronic filing is at the option of the plaintiff or the plaintiff's attorney. And if electronic filing is used, it has to comply with security and data standards established by the Supreme Court. However, if electronic filing is used, the plaintiff or plaintiff's attorney still must file with the General District Court the paper copies of any pleading needed for the proper processing of a civil action. In other words, you can file electronically, but you still have to file paper copies. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. The show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Starting July 1, significant changes to Virginia's Domestic Violence Protective Order statutes become effective. Join us next week when Palma Pistolnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explains the existing law and the improvements that take effect on the 1st of July. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.